Well, just a couple of updates before we launch into our ongoing series here on the three origins of life that we see mentioned in the Bible. Last week, we talked about the NASA announcement that they had found fossils in that meteorite, that carbonaceous chondrite meteorite, and how they published their results in the Journal of Cosmology, which was announced as a peer-reviewed journal. Well, after last Sunday, I went online and checked out the Journal of Cosmology. It's not a Journal of Cosmology. Really, it's a journal that was founded to promote panspermia. And panspermia is a model that was most strongly promoted by Fred Hoyle in the 1980s, although some credit goes, too, to people like Leslie Orgel and who's one that won the Nobel Prize? We had Watson, who won the Nobel Prize for the DNA. They promoted this idea that since life can't happen on planet Earth, and we've just been through the evidence, why, from a naturalistic perspective, life is not possible, can't possibly arise on planet Earth, and therefore it must have come from outer space. Fred Hoyle and Leslie Orgel and Watson recognized this literally in the 1970s, and said, therefore, life must have come to planet Earth from outer space, either through dust or through rocks or meteors. And this Journal of Cosmology was founded to promote the doctrine of panspermia. And, you know, the real clue I got is when I noticed that the editor of the journal made an even more extravagant statement than Hoover did. Who wrote the paper, namely saying that Hoover's paper proves that life is everywhere in the universe, it's been everywhere in the universe for 10 billion years, and that you know, everywhere we go, we're going to find life ubiquitous throughout the universe, and this explains the origin of life here on planet Earth that was dropped here 3.8 billion years ago by these kinds of meteors. And the journal is not peer-reviewed. When they talked about peer review, they said, we're sending the paper out for peer review. But that's not the same as a peer-reviewed journal. A peer-reviewed journal is where the peer review happens before the article is published, not after the article is published. And moreover, the editors of the peer-reviewed journals are committed to take an objective, neutral stance. And so that was a tip-off right away. The senior editor was not at all objective or neutral. He was very propagandistic in his statements. And to NASA's credit, within 24 hours, they distanced themselves both from Hoover and the journal. And it made it very clear that this, anyway, it was a NASA scientist that published it, but they said this is not something that is endorsed or even condoned by NASA, and they made it very clear that the Journal of Cosmology is something that NASA did not originate, and that is not peer-reviewed, and therefore said that, and then they said, you know, all the evidence coming in from external scientists is very negative towards the report. And bottom line is, the reviews that are coming in are saying that the claimed fossils are not fossils of life. This is something that happens by non-organic pathways. And something I mentioned last week is that the structures are really too big, and all they're getting is external details. There's no evidence of internal structure. But again, thanks to NASA, I mean, I really say hats off to NASA. They were quick to jump on this and say this is not credible. This is not something that's endorsed by NASA. And we're not claiming that the journal has any credibility either. In the back, Mara. Oh, Hoover's not going to get fired. I mean, well, if they fired Hoover, they'd have to fire a lot of other scientists as well. I mean, he's certainly not alone. I mean, if you look at the Journal of Cosmology, most of the articles are published by NASA scientists. And there certainly is a veneer within the NASA scientific community that has an ideology that life is everywhere in the universe. And so, I mean, they were the ones that got together and founded this journal. But it's not a traditional scientific journal. It's not a peer-reviewed journal. and it's a journal that has a clear ideological mission. Now, to the credit of the journal, they're very open about the fact that they do have an ideology. They're not claiming to be a neutral scientific journal. They are very upfront in saying, this is our bias, and that this is what we're promoting.
Everyone thinks if NASA said it, then it's got to be legit.
Well, that's why NASA was very quick to step out and say, this is not an official NASA journal. Yes, most of the articles are published by scientists under the employ of NASA, but this is not official NASA publication. And you know, that kind of you can see if you go to the website for the Journal of Cosmology, it's fairly obvious because most of the material there is designed for the lay public. They publish all kinds of blogs, short articles, really geared for the public audience. And you've got to dig down a fair ways before you find, quote, the technical articles. I was quite surprised, too, that the article that Hoover published was 53 pages long, which, you know, is uncharacteristically lengthy for a technical scientific article. And really, most of what he was doing was trying to kind of build a case for panspermia. And I think what concerned me most of all was the first few pages of the paper where he was saying, you know, we're finding the evidence for life in all these chondrite mirrors. Because he basically went through the nine, by the way, they've only found nine carbonaceous chondrite C1 meteorites total. But the first thing he did is he went through all nine and claimed that all nine had strong indicators of life. And then he gave a whole bunch of citations proving that this was strong evidence for life in these meteorites. Now, he never described it in the paper what these strong indicators were, so I actually looked up all the articles that he was citing. And it's an extreme exaggeration to say these are strong indicators of life. I mean, he claimed that in one they found the amino acid guanine. Well, it's the simplest of the amino acids. And yes, we do know that guanine exists in some of these meteorites. And almost all the evidence that these papers cite are not the kinds of meteorites that they were referring to, but rather the Murchison meteorite that fell in Australia. Well, that's one of the biggest meteorites that has struck the Earth in recent history. And yes, that does have amino acids in it and even has some nucleotides in it, but they're extremely low abundance levels. Moreover, it's not clear what is contamination from biological material in the Earth and what is actually indigenous to the meteorite. The other thing he claimed as strong evidence is that they're actually finding an excess of left-handed amino acids in these meteorites. But if you actually look at the papers, the best they're finding is a 1-9% shift towards left-handedness from right-handedness. That's not strong evidence. For life chemistry to even be feasible, it has to be 100% left-handed. And so if you're tilting towards, say, 55% left-handed and 45% right-handed, that's of no help at all. And the fact is the best you can find in any meteorite is 9% shift towards left or right. And, you know, 9% is nothing. Moreover, a lot of people claim that 9% shift is a result of terrestrial contamination. So there is no strong evidence at all in any of these meteorites for life. But again, hats off to NASA. They were very quick to jump on this. Literally within 24 hours, they jumped on this and said, this is not our position, and we're not saying there's any credibility to this at all, and this is not peer-reviewed. So, yes.
This is directly contrary, it seems to me, to your model. Contrary to books like Rare Earth and follow-on books, aren't the panspermia promoters losing ground every day?
The panspermia followers indeed are losing ground. In fact, once we get through the solar system here, I'm going to give you some evidence why panspermia is not a credible option to explain the origin of life on planet Earth, and why it's not a credible option to explain life anywhere in the universe, for that matter. But what's really driving the panspermia community is they say there's no other option. All other options to explain the origin of life from a naturalistic perspective aren't credible, and so they're saying we have to go with panspermia. In fact, I think they're right in one sense. We can't explain the origin of life on planet Earth from a naturalistic perspective. Something from outside the Earth must have done it. Well, that's partly correct. It is someone from outside the Earth that made it all happen. So in one sense, I think we have the panspermia research crowd to thank for the fact they're pushing us step by step towards the real answer for the origin of life. They're partly there. They're getting there. Well, in fact, I think I told the story last week of how Fuzz Ron and I were at one of these Origin of Life research conferences where a scientist came to the question and answer microphone and said, in this conference, we've ruled out the Earth, we've ruled out Mars, we've ruled out Europa, we've ruled out everything in the solar system, we've ruled out panspermia, we've ruled out life coming to us from a rock from another planet. He says, the only thing left is directed panspermia, that intelligent beings and spaceships came to planet Earth and put life here on planet Earth. And, you know, Fuzz and I kind of elbowed one another and said, you know, he's on the right track. It is an intelligent being that came to Earth and put life here on planet Earth, just not from another planet. So
keep going further away.
Right, right. Yeah. Hasn't gone far enough away to explain it. So, okay. Let me also give you a quick update on the Japanese earthquake. I know the pastor addressed that in the services. We also addressed it in a podcast that we recorded at Reasons to Believe on Friday. And so you can go to our website at reasons.org and get that podcast. It runs about 30 minutes long. And mainly what we did is we pointed out that there was an earthquake a few hours before the one that struck Japan that really didn't make much of a splash in the news. It was an earthquake that took place in the Yunnan province of China. But it was an earthquake that caused, in a city of 300,000 people, 140,000 were made immediately homeless. All their structures were leveled to the ground. Here's the difference. That was a 5.8 earthquake, not an 8.9. The difference is about a factor of 1,300 times in terms of energy release. And, you know, the amazing thing about this earthquake in Japan is that it caused so little damage. Now, the damage is horrific, but no nation on Earth is better prepared to deal with earthquakes than Japan. And to give you some kind of a context, historically, Japan gets 10 times the number and the intensity of earthquakes that we do here on the Pacific coast. And so they're aware of that, and they had prepared. And they were prepared for a magnitude 8, but this is a magnitude 9. The difference is a factor of 10. There's 10 times more energy released in a 9 than an 8. Or to give you another point of comparison, if you're relatively close to a magnitude 9 earthquake, it will shake the bark off of every tree. So it leaves the trees without any bark at all. That's how violent a magnitude 9 earthquake is. And so, yes, we've seen the TV shots of the damage in Japan. But the amazing thing is how well they rode that earthquake out. Notice not a single high-rise collapsed. Now, that did happen in previous earthquakes in Japan. You know, they kind of built their buildings strong, but you can go online and find photo images of previous earthquakes in Japan where you get a 12-story building going down like that. Structure is intact, but it fell down just like that. And, you know, inside, nothing damaged. But, of course, it's a little bit difficult to take a building that's fallen down and put it back up.
Yeah.
And so they had to kind of destroy it or, you know, and rebuild it. But with that previous earthquake, they actually redesigned the building so that they wouldn't fall down and they wouldn't fall apart. And so in this magnitude 9 earthquake, it's the first time in human history where you've had a magnitude 9 earthquake close to cities and then none of the tall buildings fell down.
Yeah.
Now, where they did take the damage, of course, is on the tsunamis. And as the Japanese scientists point out, it's one thing to prepare for the shaking of an earthquake. There's really no way to prepare for the tsunamis. And so, but that was 95% of the damage in Japan was the tsunamis. And most of the rest of the damage was stuff inside the buildings moving around. So, of course, books fell down, papers and furniture moved around, but the buildings, by and large, were intact.
Are they livable, most of them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, they got to clean up, of course.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, that happens with earthquakes here, too. I remember an earthquake, oh, I forget when, but we were living in a townhouse right on top of the epicenter in Monrovia. It was only a magnitude 6, but because we were right on top of the epicenter, it caused one of our chest of drawers to be slammed from one side of the room to the other side of the room, hit the wall, and shattered.
Wow.
But as we looked at the wall, we couldn't even see a scratch. I mean, the building rotted out very well. Our furniture was destroyed and had to be replaced, but our townhouse didn't even have any cracks in it. So our building codes do a pretty decent job. Of course, our building codes are not designed for a magnitude 9. On the other hand, we know that California's fault system is such that it will not allow a magnitude 9. There's really no risk of a magnitude 9 in the state of California unless you go as far up as Crescent City. Then there is a risk of a magnitude 9. And incidentally, that's the major lesson we need to learn from Japan, is we have a fault system that's virtually identical to what happened off of northern Japan. In Oregon, Washington, down to a little bit of northern California, and on up into southern British Columbia, there is a fault line that's offshore. And interestingly, it's offshore by almost the identical amount the one in Japan is. Namely, something between 60 and 100 miles, depending where you are along the shoreline. And just like the one in Japan, when it does rupture, it releases a magnitude 9. And the last time that happened was 1,000 years ago. But historical records tell us that happens about once every 1,000 years. So we're due for another one at that time. Unlike Japan, however, the Pacific Northwest is completely unprepared. And as I mentioned in the podcast on Friday, the Japanese were following a biblical mandate. Build your house on a rock, not on the sand. Realize natural disasters happen and prepare accordingly. So hats off to the Japanese. They did prepare. We in America have prepared here in California, but this is really the only state in the Union where there's any attempt to prepare for earthquakes, and yet we're not the most earthquake-prone state in the Union. There are many states in the Union where the risk of earthquake damage is far greater than it is here in California. And what appalls me is those states are not prepared. They still have unreinforced brick structures everywhere. And that stuff comes down in a 6, let alone a 7, 8, or 9. Yeah, in the back, John. Well, as we mentioned in the podcast, if you look at all the large nations of the world, the one that is greatest risk for serious damage and loss of life due to disasters is the United States of America. Unlike Japan, we get everything. We get tornadoes, we get volcanoes, we get earthquakes, we get droughts, we get floods, we get wildfires. We got it all. More than 80% of the tornadoes that occur in the world occur in the United States. So, yes.
Yeah, on the tsunamis, it's one thing to talk about the height of the wave. We say, I think they talk about it in Japan, say maybe like 20 feet, something like that. But see, isn't more of the damage due to the volume of how extensive the wave is past the frontal rise? I mean, so it's the volume of water. that washes ashore that really caused damage. And do you have any, can you explain that a little bit? I mean, say you have a 20-foot wave, what's the distance of water?
Okay, what happens in a tsunami is that, you know, if you've got an earthquake, and, you know, subduction zones are where you've got the greatest risk. And that's where you say you've got the Pacific plate sliding under the North American plate. And when that ruptures, it causes a great movement of water. And that water causes a wave to travel on the surface. And it travels at roughly 500 miles an hour. But when it's on the surface, where there's no impeding land and deep ocean, the height of the wave is typically about 1 foot only. And so, if you know a tidal wave is coming and you've got a boat that you don't want to get damaged, what you're supposed to do is take it out to sea. And even though the wave is moving at 500 miles an hour, because it's only 1 foot, you can ride it out. But if you stay in harbor, this is where you have a problem, because as the wave approaches land, it gets shallower and shallower at the depth of the water, which causes this 1 foot wave to build up. Now, it does cause it to slow down. So it slows down from 500 miles an hour to, say, 100 miles an hour, and the wave might build up to be 5 or 6 feet high. And as it comes into land, it can change. And a lot has to do with the geography of the land. Where you get the greatest risk, say in North America, would be a place like Port Alberni, which is a major harbor on Vancouver Island. But it's at the foot of a fjord. And so what you have is kind of a triangular piece of water going into a city. And it basically focuses the tidal wave. And so it comes in at an enormous height with a large volume of water and, you know, a relatively minor earthquake several decades ago wiped out the first three city blocks of Port Alberni, which is where they had their downtown core. Well, having had that experience, they've now moved their downtown core up to higher land. Unfortunately, I've been to Port Alberni, it rises up pretty quickly. So there are things you can do. You can't really predict unless you know the geography of the shoreline. Crescent City has a similar situation where it focuses the energy of a tidal wave. And so Crescent City will take more damage than, say, other ports along the Pacific Northwest. The Columbia River is a bad place to be because, again, you've got this body of water that kind of can focus everything in. And so I think there's a bridge that goes across the Columbia River at its mouth, and there's a city there. They're at significant risk. Yeah. Again, John.
I was just thinking in terms of the propagation of waves, to understand that the wavelength is probably around 50 miles. So if you even have only 1 or 2 foot elevation of water, it's over a 50 mile length. And then when it reaches even without focus, it reaches the coastline, as the first water arrives, there's more behind it, it has no place to go, and it'll keep
building up. Well, I think you got to see that on television as they showed you that tidal wave coming into the plain Sendai, is that the water just kept coming and coming and coming. It wasn't just a single wave. And that's because, the crest of the wave is so broad. That's also the reason why you can easily ride it out if you're out in the ocean. So if you're out in deep ocean, a tidal wave isn't going to do you any harm. But if you're in close to shore, that's where the great risk is. So. Exactly. I mean, you could be in an ocean liner in the middle of the ocean and not even know a tidal wave has gone by. So, but people on the shoreline will be ready. And by the way, when a tidal wave approaches, it sucks the water out. The first thing you notice is all the water gets sucked out. I mean, you can see that even with ocean waves crashing on the beach. When a big wave comes in, first thing it does is it pulls water out. But with a big tidal wave, it'll pull the water out for about 20 whole minutes. And what has happened in the past is when a big tidal wave like that happens, it pulls all the water out. People on the shoreline, before they knew about this, says, oh, we can harvest all the crabs and clams that are out there. So they all rush out in there, start harvesting things, and of course the tidal wave comes in. So that's where there's been horrific loss of life in the past. But fortunately, people now know what tidal waves are like. And when they see the water being sucked out, that means you've got 20 minutes to get to high ground. So if you're ever in some vacation place and you're out of contact with radio and TV and the internet, and you see the water being sucked out like that, you better get to high ground in a hurry. So in a hurry, you got 20 minutes. Although, better make it 15. So, yeah, go ahead. It's complicated. I mean, you're better off if the land shore is kind of like a concave thing, or pardon me, convex. That helps blunt the energy of the wave. Whereas if it's concave, that focuses it. So that's more difficult. Yeah, how quickly the seafloor rises up to a shallow level makes a real difference. And what the composition is makes a difference. The temperature makes a difference. That's why it's very difficult when they say a tidal wave is coming for them, the scientists, to be able to give the people on shore precise information about exactly what's going to happen. For example, a warning went out to all the sea villages along the California coast. They told people to pull back from Seal Beach, for example, but they couldn't tell the people at Seal Beach how big the wave would be when it would hit, and how fast it would be moving, how much volume of water. They could only tell them to win it about a factor of 5. That's because there's just too many factors involved in trying to calculate exactly what's going to happen. I think what Seal Beach got was just 3 feet. So, and people were watching it, and some of them weren't even aware it was a tidal wave. So, but it could have been 9 feet. I mean, that's how big the error bars were. Yeah, in the back. You always hear California. We definitely get the greatest frequency of earthquakes, but we don't get the greatest intensity of earthquakes. The three places that are much greater risk than California would be Alaska. I think most of us are aware Alaska does get big earthquakes, and many of them. Another place would be the fault that's offshore from Washington and Oregon. The other one is the one in Missouri, the Madrid fault. So that's places where you can get 9s. Alaska can get 9s, Missouri can get a 9, and Washington and Oregon can get 9s. But the worst we're going to get here is an 8. Not that an 8 is an easy thing to survive. Yeah, you're next. Highest we can get here would probably be like an 8.2, 8.3. So that's still pretty bad. And like the San Onofre nuclear power plant is designed to withstand a 7 within 5 miles. But that translates to being able to withstand an 8 within 50 miles. And so, people were really worried, gee, it can only withstand a 7. But the chances of them getting an 8 within 5 miles is pretty close to 0. I mean, it's the San Andreas that'll generate an 8. And the San Andreas is considerably north of us here. So we can get 7s in the Sierra Madre area, but not 8s. So, in the back.
I heard a news report that said that another tidal wave could come after the first one. And
yes.
It would be a larger one. Is that true? And if so, how does that work?
Well, with every big earthquake, every earthquake has aftershocks. Even the small ones have aftershocks. Aftershocks are typically like a factor of 10 to a factor of 100 times weaker than the main shock. But keep in mind, sometimes you can get what you think is the main shock, and it actually is the precursor to a bigger earthquake. And so what they tell you is whenever you get a big earthquake, realize that within 24 hours of that quake, there is a possibility you can get an even bigger quake. Possibility, not a probability. But it's a foregone conclusion that you will get weaker aftershocks. And for example, Japan did get a 7.4 earthquake as an aftershock to the 8.9. And yeah, depending how that 7.4 is manifested, it could actually generate a bigger tsunami than the 8.9. Again, the physics of tsunamis is very complex. And so that's why they said just because the 8.9 has happened doesn't mean that you're out of the woods in terms of tsunami damage. So, I mean, what causes a tsunami is, you know, a rupture on the seafloor, and depending how big the rupture is and how fast the rupture is, determines what kind of tsunami you will get. And keep in mind, when they say 8.9, that's a measure of the total energy release. So if you release that energy over 15 minutes, that could be a lot less damaging than if you have, say, a magnitude 8 earthquake where all the energy is focused into 4 seconds. So then you can actually get a bigger wave. So that's why they put that proviso out.
At least over a long period, long space.
Yeah, well, again, the Richter scale measures the total energy release. So that would be the length of the earthquake, the duration of the earthquake, multiplied by the average shaking energy in that earthquake. So, yeah, the longer you put it over, then the less violent the shaking would be. On the other hand, that's not always good news for a structure. A structure is typically designed to handle shaking for a period of time. If you shake it for a long period of time, it's much more likely to fall apart than if you shake it for a short time. And so having it last for 15 minutes might not be a good thing. In fact, a friend of mine was riding out a magnitude 6.6 earthquake, and he was in this apartment structure, and he said the earthquake stopped just short of causing the building to collapse. And you know, he wrote it out for about 40 seconds, but he said if it lasted even 5 seconds longer, it would have collapsed the whole structure. So, yeah.
I heard on the TV something about this whole event moving the island.
Yes. Yeah, this is a big enough earthquake that it actually shifted the position of the big island of Honshu in Japan. By a measurable amount, and it even disturbed the rotation rate of the Earth. Most earthquakes slow down the rotation rate. This one sped it up. Now, it's nothing that you have to worry about in terms of changing your clocks. It added up to just 1 microsecond. So,
tilted the axis, I think they said.
Yeah, tilts the axis, but again, we're talking tiny amounts. Yeah, we're only talking movements of inches. So, but yeah, it did do that. It literally shifted the entire island.
I think the shift was 8 feet, and this is the first time they've actually accurately measured it because they actually had GPS sensors all over the island. So this was the first one they actually had really good measurements.
Well, a friend of mine who's the chairman of the seismology department at the University of Nevada, Reno, he actually chases these things because he says, you know, when a big earthquake happens, you know there's going to be aftershocks, and if we get there in time, we can actually set up all of our equipment and do this kind of a research. So he's been through a number of big earthquakes. you know, that's the wonderful thing about California and Japan is that we have the equipment in place. So when an earthquake happens, we can learn a lot about the earthquake. And by the way, the earthquake that hit Alaska in 1960, it also moved that part of the state by, they estimate, about 10 feet. So, in fact, I remember seeing photographs where it showed a railway line and the rails were actually shifted out by many feet. You know, the interesting thing is just the odd way the energy can be distributed. There were 2 9-story towers in downtown Anchorage. One was totally destroyed, the one right next to it completely intact. In fact, the people in that tower didn't even know an earthquake had happened. And yet the one in the next building was totally destroyed. So, well, that's the other thing about earthquakes is the energy is not evenly distributed. Some places get hit a lot harder than places that are literally just...
Was one on bedrock?
Well, I'm not sure the physics of it all, but when I visited Anchorage for the first time, they said, you see this tower here? There was one just like it right next to it that got wiped out by the earthquake. Yeah, I mean, you know, there's weird things that can happen. So, but yeah, well, the amazing thing was the people in one tower didn't even know an earthquake was happening. So, Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think every human being on the earth that's seen that event considers the shortness of life when they see that, as well as the empathy for the Japanese people. And the good Lord doesn't need an earthquake to finish off. You know, so I think it's a hint to us all. Every human being that saw that on TV, that has heard about it, every atheist, every Buddhist, every... just all of humanity realizes what happened.
Yeah, I think the main concern we had in doing our podcast is people would say, well, you know, how could an all-powerful, all-loving God tolerate exposing human beings to such a devastating earthquake? And so the main emphasis of our podcast are the benefits of earthquakes and how without earthquakes there wouldn't even be a possibility of human life here on planet Earth. And so we kind of reviewed all the good things that earthquakes do, and also made the point that earthquake activity is subsiding. Earthquake activity is a lot less today than it was, say, a billion years ago. And so God waited to the ideal earthquake moment to put human beings here on planet Earth, where we have just enough earthquakes to maintain human civilization, but not so much as to make human civilization impossible. But without earthquake activity, you're not going to have the buildup of continental land masses. And without the buildup of continental land masses, you can't have the recycling of nutrients. And so without recycling of nutrients, there's no possibility for advanced life.
Well, also, a lot of souls went to heaven that day.
Mm-hmm.
Some, sadly, went to hell. That's just the fact. What about old Ted? You know, it's a good reminder to Ted. Watch the way you're
walking. Well, Jesus addressed this when people asked him about disasters, you know, the Tower of Siloam falling down and killing all the people, and he said, these things happen. This is the way the universe was designed. I mean, we have gravity, we have thermodynamics, we have electromagnetism. We're all living proof that, you know, this goes on. And, you know, even without earthquakes, I can tell you this, gravity will cause your chin to sag as you get older and older. So it's an inevitable consequence of the physics. And, you know, and God could remove that. He could get rid of the law of gravity. He could get rid of electromagnetism. He could get rid of the thermodynamics, and there would never be any earthquakes. But if he did that, we wouldn't have the physics as critical for bringing about the end of all evil and suffering. And so there's a reason why we live in a universe with these laws of physics. And there's a reason why God doesn't miraculously intervene to rescue us from every disaster. You know, what if he stepped in and rescued us from every hurricane, tornado, wildfire, and earthquake? The effect that that would have would be to blunt the impact of the laws of physics and persuading us that we are beings bent on an evil path, and that we need these laws of physics to restrain our evils. Because of these laws of physics, we don't do all the evil that we possibly could do. The physics acts as a barrier preventing us from committing all the evil that resides within our hearts. And so it's a good thing. And if God rescued us every time, then that effect of restraining the expression of evil would be removed. And so God intervenes only on rare occasions. And what you see in the New Testament, the only time he intervenes is when that miraculous intervention would have a greater impact on restraining evil than letting the course of the laws of physics run the way they do. But I can tell you this, we live at the optimal hurricane moment. Hurricanes were more intense in the past, but we're living at the best possible time for hurricane activity. We're also living at the best time in terms of wildfires and tornadoes and the volcanoes and the earthquakes. Everything is optimized to be at the very best level, not too great, not too small. So we got enough earthquake activity to maintain the recycling of nutrients, but it's not so high as to stop us from building cities. Yeah, go ahead.
The violent shaking earthquakes, and then the ones that roll, which one does more damage, and which one causes greater
It depends. A rolling earthquake can cause a lot of damage because rolling earthquakes last longer than the violent shaking earthquakes. And if you've got a rolling earthquake that goes on for 15 minutes, that could begin to stress the structures and cause them to fall down. On the other hand, if you have a whole lot of energy released in, say, a two-second window, that could immediately collapse a building. So again, it depends. Bottom line is what I said before. This kind of science is complex. And this is what frustrates lay people. They go to Caltech and say, can you tell us what's going on here? And you get this Caltech geophysicist giving a 10-minute monologue, and it's because this is really complicated stuff. There's a reason why we can't predict earthquakes. But we're getting, you know, more and more information as time goes on. In fact, I saw a paper published just 1 month ago where they were exhorting China to do the same thing Japan has done, basically to begin surrounding the nation of China with seismographs. And it said if we were to do that in Chile, if we were to do that all around the Pacific Rim, we could actually develop the database we need to really understand earthquakes and tsunamis at a level where we could really help people better prepare. Because in terms of just saying to the people of Seattle, you need to change your building codes, what would be good would be for a geophysicist to tell the people in Seattle exactly how they need to change their building codes, what they need to do and what they don't need to do. But that's going to take better data. And so one of the exciting things, possibly, about this big earthquake in Japan, it's going to give us data we've never had before. So in the next year or two, we're going to learn a whole lot from this event in Japan that could really help us better prepare, but we need to be committed to prepare. And one thing that concerns me about the United States of America, we desperately need a financial nest egg to deal with the inevitable coming natural disasters. And where's the nest egg? I don't see it anywhere. So, and we also need to begin to upgrade our building codes and begin to invest in an infrastructure that can withstand these kinds of disasters. And I'm not just talking earthquakes. There's many other things that threaten the American well-being, and we need to prepare. And I would argue this is a biblical principle, that we should prepare for these things. And so we are at great risk, much greater risk than Japan. Yes.
When the British Petroleum debacle happened, I was reading that they're drilling so far down that they're hitting the plates. Is there a danger? I mean, the plates are held together by friction. Is there a danger that something can be drilled down to make the plates slippery and then force it? Would that be a danger?
Well, that might be actually a good thing. I mean, if we could kind of force down a lot of lubricant into the subduction zone, then those plates would be able to slide more efficiently and not release these devastating earthquakes. That would be an amazing engineering feat for us to be able to do that. And actually, that's one of the incredible things, or I can say outstanding aspects of planet Earth. Is we do see other bodies that have plate tectonics on it. What's unique about the Earth is we have the greatest plate tectonic activity taking place on the ocean floor. And if the ocean is deep enough, you get this dense water that will chemically react with the basalts to make talc. And so we get the production of a lubricant at these plates. And that's why we don't get magnitude 11s and 12s, is because we live in a planet where the subduction zones have the efficient production of talc, which is a lubricant that causes the place to slide more efficiently. So maybe we could pump down a lot of the silicone or whatever down there and make it slip a little more easily. But it's already designed with a natural lubricant. And that because of that natural lubricant, we can live in cities. Yes?
Yes, can you comment on Revelation toward, I think, the middle or end of it? It says, and there was an earthquake so massive, every mountain and island flood away. Just, what would that be? What magnitude? Just, you're the physicist.
Well, you know, I've read that passage, and what it would take would be an event around the Pacific Rim. I mean, that's something that's come up in the news just in the last couple of days, that this was an earthquake that took place on the Ring of Fire. And there's a 40,000-mile-long ring around the Pacific Ocean basin where 90% of all the earthquakes and volcanoes occur. And, you know, in reading that passage in Revelation, it would take an event that would trigger the eruption of earthquakes and tornadoes around the entire ring. You know, that could bring about the kind of devastation you see there in that passage.
You had to ask, didn't you?
So, well, just to kind of, I mean, there's another way to be interpreting those passages, because, you know, Revelation 6 and 8 and 16 speak about these earthquakes that will come, and all of the discourse says at the time of the end there will be a vast increase in earthquakes. And I think we can interpret that as an actual increase in the number and of intensity of earthquakes. But as you look at the entire Olivet discourse, it talks about famines and economic crises, and it seems to all be in the context of the impact that it has on humanity. And therefore, given the population and given the technology and where people live today, you might be able to fulfill those prophecies without increasing the number of intensity of earthquakes. In other words, we interpret it as how many people die and how much damage takes place to the human economic system. You know, we've been getting about 5 magnitude 9s per century throughout all of recorded human history. But typically those 9s have been taking place where people don't live. And so, you know, we're now thinking, wow, we live in a time where we're getting way more earthquakes than we have in the past. Well, actually, historically, that's not true. The earthquakes we're getting today are no different than the earthquakes of the past. What's different is we've got huge populations of people living on the zones where the risk of volcanic and earthquake activity is the greatest. And so today, we're suffering an order of magnitude more damage and more human death than we have in the past. And maybe that's how we're to interpret the Olivet discourse. A vast increase in human suffering as a result of earthquake activity. So maybe a factor or two increase in the earthquake activity would be sufficient to fulfill the Olivet discourse, just based on the state of humanity today.
Well, couldn't the language work says where all the mountains are made level? There's a certain logic to Jewish apocalyptic language, which is deliberate, intentional hyperbole, where not literally every single mountain would be flattened, but in other words, it's saying there's going to be a whole lot of shaking going on.
Well, I kind of studied that passage about 25 years ago.
Yeah.
We actually taught about it in this class here, and how this phrase about the leveling of the mountains in the Hebrew-Jewish understanding is the idea that you get massive landslides. And so it's not meaning that the mountain is going to be leveled down to sea level.
Yeah.
Rather, what we're going to see is so much violent shaking that significant material would be eroded off the mountain and come down. And that's a terrifying thing to experience when, say, a slab of a mountain slips off and crashes down into the valley below. So, and keep in mind, where do most of the mountains exist? They exist along the Ring of Fire. So, okay, over here. We're talking a microsecond.
Okay.
So, yeah, this is, and when they talk about the movement of the rotation axis of the Earth, it's a few centimeters or inches. We're not talking feet.
Right. So we're measuring that by satellites?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what is the rotational speed of the Earth right now?
24 hours a day. I'm sorry about that. So you can look that up on Wikipedia if you want. what I heard was that rotation rate of the Earth was sped up by just a microsecond a day. So, and by the way, with the aftershocks, that could be, eliminated to a large degree. So, but yeah, when a big earthquake happens, it will move the ground in the immediate area. It can move the rotation axis and affect the rotation rate. But if you average it out over time, it has a zero impact. So the earthquake that took place a couple of years ago in Chile did the opposite effect. It slowed down the rotation rate. So people are worried, are earthquakes going to make a big difference in the rotation rate of the Earth? The answer is it's a zero impact because it all averages out to zero.
And Newton's law applies.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it has to balance out somewhere. So, yeah. So no need to worry. By the way, our rotation rate is slowing down in a very consistent fashion as a result of tidal friction. So that's the real thing to worry about in terms of what's happening to a rotation rate. Earthquakes have a null effect, but the tidal friction has a positive effect. You say, how much of an effect? Well, in about 150 million years from now, we'll have a 25-hour day. So if you want to get an extra hour's worth of work in, just wait 150 million years. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, for those building houses, the other thing that's really affected as far as buildings coming down is how much water you have in the soil.
Right.
So when they had the Northbrook earthquake, I had an office builder that was in Sherman Oaks, way away from the epicenter, and yet the building I was in was totaled. They came in and tried to understand why my one building sustained so much damage. Because it was kind of at a lower basin, and so the water table was higher, and so the ground shook like jelly. And it was the same thing that happened up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And right there, again, there's all the houses near the bay, where again the water table was very, very high to the ground. Obviously, it shook more. So I guess it's very complex because even just the amount of water or airspace in the soil will affect it.
Well, that's had a personal thing with me. We used to live in a townhouse that was on top of a pile of granite in San Dimas. We did not have earthquake insurance because I realized, our earthquake risk was quite low given where our townhouse was. Very good building codes, and we're on top of this granite rock. And now we live in a home that is right near San Dimas Canyon Creek, and that's kind of a river basin. And we're up at a fairly good distance, so I'm not too worried, but now we have earthquake insurance. Because I realize it's not quite as secure as where we were, and I've also spent quite a bit of money putting cross beams in on the bottom of our house, feeling, it's not enough that it's bolted to the foundation. We need to increase the structure beyond what we had before. So, it's different everywhere where you live. You got to analyze it. Yeah, go ahead.
When you say the island moved 8 feet, exactly in relationship to what, to the continental land mass? Is it still attached to the plate that it's on? Is it because the whole plate moved?
The entire plate moved, right. So the whole island moved 8 feet.
In relation to what?
In relation to the Pacific plate, it moved 8 feet.
Closer.
So, I don't know.
Have a GPS sensor that's on the island, and then that GPS sensor, it would be as if you got up and walked 8 feet with your GPS device. So all the GPS markers on that island are no good anymore because all numbers are all wrong by 8 feet. That's how we can tell the accuracy, because of the GPS. GPS can get you down within inches, obviously.
And the GPS is measuring the position of various places on the Earth relative to the stars. Yeah.
So, if they had a station on the island and then on the mainland where they could measure the distance apart between those two points,
they could do that.
Would it have moved? Would it be different, or would the whole land mass have moved, or what?
Yeah, it did move, and exactly how and which direction, I don't know.
No,
you can check the GPS data to find out. But yeah, all those poor people in Japan are going to have to get new GPS data in order to figure out where the lanes are on the freeway. And that's not trivial, because they're actually putting up a new set of GPS satellites that will be able to pinpoint objects on the surface of the Earth to 18 inches. And with that kind of accuracy, big earthquakes means you've got to recreate your database. Okay, in the back. The nuclear reactor problem. Well, the news is still developing on that, but the Russian nuclear agency came out and basically told the world, this is not a Chernobyl. And so in Chernobyl, we did not have any encasing of the actual reactor. The Japanese do. And so they've got reinforced concrete all around the nuclear core, and the nuclear core does suffer a meltdown. They will probably be able to contain it. So their main worry is that they poured water on the rods and the pouring of water lowered the temperature, which lowered the risk of the meltdown, but now has made the rods brittle. And so there's a bit of concern about what those brittle rods might mean for the future. So, but, you know, the Japanese nuclear scientists are among the most competent ones in the world, and they did prepare for this. However, they prepared kind of like we did. They built their nuclear reactors taking into account a magnitude 8. They were not building them for a magnitude 9. And so that's why they're scrambling now, saying, well, you know, this is a bigger earthquake than we prepared for, and therefore they're trying to take whatever precautions they can. From what I understand, there's two reactors that are at risk, one more so than the other, and watch the news over the next 24 hours. So I can't give you an answer more definitive than that. So, but yeah, there are some concerns. And by the way, those concerns need to transfer over here to America. We got nuclear reactors in places we shouldn't have them. And, you know, we have, I mean, what if a magnitude 9 were to take place on the Madrid Fault? What's that going to mean for the nuclear reactors in that area? So, well, I'm hoping our nation will learn the lesson from Japan. I mean, that should be a wake-up call to America that we need to be better prepared. And, you know, Japan has never had a magnitude 9 in recorded history. Japanese have been on those islands for 10,000 years. This is the first time, as far as we know, of an earthquake of that magnitude has ever taken place. It can happen here in America. In fact, we know there are three places in America where it's bound to happen relatively near in the future, within the next few hundred years. And so we would be wise to learn a lesson from what happened in Japan and get ready, and in particular, stop having $1.5 trillion deficit every year. We need to be putting aside $1 trillion as a nest egg towards certain natural disasters. So, whether we'll do it or not, I don't know, but that would be a wise thing to do. Yes?
I think I heard on the news that we had sent over some kind of coolant to Japan. And do you know anything about that?
Yes. I mean, that's one thing where I commend America. When disasters happen elsewhere, we're among the first to respond. And so America is showing a lot of generosity towards helping people in need.
What kind of coolant is that?
I don't know. So, you know, we're still trying to figure out exactly what the risk on those two reactors are. So, but again, I do believe the Russians are right when they're trying to reassure the world's population this will not be a Chernobyl. That doesn't mean it won't be a significant disaster, but it's going to not be like Chernobyl where you get a radiation wind blowing over the entire planet. Yeah. No, the amount of money we spend in helping other people with their national disasters has an immeasurable effect on our debt. There are many other reasons why we have a really big debt. So, yeah, go ahead.
I want to follow Jim's question, which I like, because it has a causative. If things move, islands move, where do they go to? Do they pile up? And we can talk about subduction.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is why we have mountains. I mean, the Himalayas weren't there 50 million years ago. They're a direct result of the Indian subcontinent getting detached from Antarctica, moving north at high velocity, relatively high velocity.
Yeah, define high velocity.
8 inches a year. 8 inches a year, is that's the fastest plate movement that's ever been measured on an average basis. And so starting 50 million years ago, India collided with Asia. And by the way, India is still moving north. So those mountains are getting higher and higher and higher as India continues to push forward at about 4 inches a year into the Asian continent. So, and that explains why you see seashells on top of Mount Everest. The Himalayas are seabed material that got crumpled up when India collided with Asia. So, and by the way, there are places in the world where the plates are separating, there are places in the world where they're coming together. So some places you get mountain building, other places you get basin formation. So it works both ways. So, again, it's complicated. And I was hoping to. go ahead.
They, getting back to this ground again, they actually now don't have the ground that they had that these houses were on the north coast. I mean, it's gone, huh? I mean, the island wasn't thick enough there to keep it. I understand that it just disappeared.
What disappeared? It's gone, right.
Yeah. I find that.
Well, that's because it's almost right at the epicenter. And, there you're going to get a lot more. But by the way, every few mile you're away from the epicenter makes a big difference.
So if you own land at the seashore, you've lost your real estate.
Well, as I tell my sons, we're the owners of future mountain property. where our home resides, it's moving upwards at 9 millimeters a year on the average. So won't be long on an astronomical time scale before we'll be able to have a nice ski place right behind our backyard.
The mountains are coming down at about 10 millimeters per year.
They're being eroded as well. So. Yeah, so. Well, especially since we have this policy here in the Los Angeles Basin of selling our mountains to gravel companies. So, if anybody lives in Duarte, you know what I'm talking about. Okay, I do actually have 5 minutes, so what I'm going to do is jump into our little study here on why, now that we've eliminated life from Earth and from Europa, or pardon me, from Mars, people have gone to Europa. What we notice with the moons, Europa, by the way, is a moon of Jupiter. And two of the moons of Jupiter we know are very water-rich. I told you earlier that the Earth is 0.03% water. Europa is 35% water. And I think it's Callisto that's 65% water. Water is the second most abundant molecule in the universe. And by the way, we have moons of Saturn that are also extremely water-rich. Now, the mantra of many of the Origin of Life researchers in the NASA community is, wherever you got water, you're going to find life. That's kind of what was going on in that Journal of Cosmology. And that's why they've been so excited about Europa. It's got water. Now, one of the reasons they're especially excited about Europa as opposed to Callisto, Callisto's got more water. But Europa is closer to Jupiter than Callisto. Close enough that it gets tidal friction. And so the thinking in the Origin of Life research community is even though the surface of Mars is frozen water and permanently frozen, underneath the surface of Europa, you could have liquid water because of tidal friction with Jupiter. And so, here's Jupiter and you got Europa and what that tidal friction does is it acts more strongly on the front side of Europa than it does the back side. And that generates heat. And so if you've got enough tidal friction, that will cause the water interior to Europa to liquefy, even though the surface is frozen solid. Now, that's why there's been this proposal, let's go to Europa and drill a hole through the ice, and then we'll put through that hole a movie camera that will go down into the liquid water and look for the bacteria that we know must be swimming there. That's kind of what's going on. And what NASA is telling, some of you guys work at JPL. A lot of them
that's
are...
going to keep us employed for the next 10 years.
That's right. Well, my JPL friends say this all can be done for $2 billion. Maybe today it's $3 billion. It was $2 billion about 10 years ago, so I imagine it's around $3 billion right now that this all could be done. Pardon me?
Send money. We'll do something bigger.
Well, one thing that's put a bit of a damper on this $3 billion project is the fact that we now know that the ice is a bit thicker than what we thought. So the thinking was maybe the ice is only 2 miles thick. But they've done some more calculations on what that tidal friction would be like and realized it must be at least 25 kilometers thick and maybe be as much as 40 kilometers thick. Now that means that you've got a lot more drilling to do to get through the ice to get to the bottom. But the thickness of the ice poses another problem. If the ice is at least 25 kilometers thick, then you're stuck with what's called the oxidants-no-oxidants paradox. That if you have oxidants in the interior of Europa, those oxidants will immediately put to a stop prebiotic chemistry. Oxidants are toxic to prebiotic chemistry. And so the Origin of Life community says, well, we're not talking about that. No oxidants in the interior. We don't know that, but if the oxidants are there, there's no possibility for the Origin of Life on Europa. But we do see oxidants on the surface. And actually, that's appealed to by the Origin of Life community because although oxidants will prevent prebiotic chemistry, oxidants are essential to maintain life. Without oxidants, you will die. You have to have oxidants. All life has to have oxidants. But the thinking was this. Okay, we have a planet with no oxidants in the interior, so the origin of life can happen. And once life originates, the oxidants on the surface somehow get through the ice down to the bottom and maintain the life that's there. That's a bit of a stretch in the sense that you've got to keep the oxidants away until you get the origin of life, then get the oxidants through. So that's kind of like the house that Jack built problem. But now that we know how thick the ice is, we realize the oxidants on the surface can't get through to the interior. And given that they can't get through, you can't sustain life. And likewise, as we've been talking about Mars and Earth having the oxygen ultraviolet crisis, the same thing is true for Europa. And just like with Mars and the Earth, there's no way to resolve the homochirality problem. Even if you got the prebiotics, the nucleotides, the sugars, the amino acids, there's no mechanism that can possibly work on the surface of Europa or the interior of Europa that can cause all the amino acids to become left-handed and the pentose sugars to become right-handed. And so it's been, almost 12 years now, not 12 years, 6-7 years ago that the Origin of Life research community backed off from Europa and said Europa cannot be a site for the Origin of Life, and for that matter none of the moons of the solar system can be a site for the Origin of Life because all the moons of Jupiter and Saturn suffer from these four Origin of Life blocking problems. Now, there still nevertheless is this idea, let's go to Europa, drill a hole through the ice, and put a camera down there and see what we can find. Maybe we can detect amino acids there, or pentose sugars, or whatever. But there's actually a very cheap way we can effectively rule out this kind of a spending initiative. And that's for a few million dollars, simply to put a satellite orbiting around Europa. That's a very cheap thing to do. And if we were to do that, that would immediately give us the tidal friction between Jupiter and Europa. Right now, we're kind of guessing what that tidal friction is. But if we put a satellite around Europa, that gives us very accurate data exactly what that tidal friction is. That might be a real help, because the answer we might get back is it's ice all the way down to the interior. Or it's just slushy stuff you're going to find. You're not going to find liquid water. Or you might come back and say, yeah, there's liquid water there, but it's really hot. So either way, you'd be able to put a limit on this and just say, you know, before we spend the $3 billion, let's spend a few million to see if there's even a possibility that we could drill through the ice and find anything interesting. Incidentally, I'm on record as saying maybe it's a good thing to do the spend the $3 billion. Not that it's going to solve any origin of life problems, but it'd be really neat to be able to go through a layer of ice, and if there's liquid water there, let's see what's going on in terms of the geophysics of that satellite and how that satellite formed. I would argue that's worth the $3 billion to do that kind of research. Forget about life. Forget about the origin of life. Let's learn about the geophysics of the formation and maintenance of these icy planets. That'd be a good thing to do. And it would help us in our research on extrasolar planets. Rather than trying to figure this out on planets that are 10, 20, 50, 100 light years away, we can go to the satellites in our own solar system and then get really good data. So don't get me wrong. I'm not against doing that GPL experiment. I think we ought to go ahead and do it. But we need to do it for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. I would also say to my JPL friends, if you're honest with the public about what this is realistically going to produce, they'll continue to fund you. But if you promise something that you can't deliver, don't be surprised if they come back and say, why are we funding JPL research? So hopefully we can get this back on track. Searching for life is, but if you keep telling people that you're going to find life, it's like crying wolf. Eventually they're going to say, forget it, we're not going to fund this anymore. But if you can get people excited about the geophysical history of the planets of our solar system and what this will imply for extrasolar planets, now you're going to get 100% taxpayer support, because this is positive research, not negative research. I'm out of time. Next week we're actually going to talk about interstellar cloud life possibility and panspermia and what the real answer to the origin of life is. So bow with me for prayer. Father in heaven, we do want to pray for the people in Japan. Pray, Father, that you would assist them in the rescue efforts and the rebuilding of the infrastructure there. We pray that you would grant both the Japanese and the foreign nuclear engineer experts that are there and making the wisest possible decisions and protecting those nuclear reactors and guaranteeing as much as possible of the safety of the population in that area. Lord, we are grateful that you work within the Japanese government and the Japanese people to properly prepare them for this event. And Father, I pray that we in America and the other nations of the world would learn a lesson from this example and prepare for the inevitable that will take place here. And Lord, I pray too that you would continue to endow the American people and our American government with a spirit of generosity to help people around the world that are in need. And Father, we would continue to show Christian character and Christian charity as a testimony to the world of what you're prepared to do for all of humanity. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you.